Well, good evening. Welcome back to our study of kind of the never changing quiet Middle East. So we are in a 3-week series. And if just to remember, in our last lesson, we talked about Christian views of the end times and how that interacts with the Middle East. In this lesson, I want to just switch points of view. I want to look at it from the Islamic view of the end times and how that drives some of what's going on in the Middle East. And then in our last lesson, next time, we will talk about the various players and where things stand today in the Middle East. Let me say a prayer for us and we'll dive right in. Lord, thank you for the mercy that you've shown to us. We're grateful that we live in the country in which we live. We pray, Lord, that we would be agents of justice and peace in our country. And I pray that our country would be an agent of peace in the world. I pray for our leaders that you would guide them. I pray that they could put malice aside. But we know, Lord, that you are sovereign and in all things, everything bends to your will. Pray that you give us faith and courage in Christ's name. Amen. Well, as always, here's the number for questions during class. It's on your handout online as well. If you want to text in questions, we answer as many as we can during class. So, Middle East, we started with a look. Here's a, this doesn't have every player on it, but it's a good little Middle East map. When we talked about the Christian views, and there are several Christian views, the series on Revelation, which you can find on our website at resources.crossings.church, we go through 4 orthodox views of the book of Revelation. There are a lot of views of Revelation. I just want to pick the ones that are that believe the Bible is true. So 4 orthodox, broadly speaking, views of the book of Revelation. And we focused last time on the one that's probably most popular. And that's kind of a dispensational view of the end times. The point I want to make to start out with, though, is that Christian eschatology, meaning the Christian view, the biblical view of how history will wind up, the end times, the way God brings history to an end, in this universe anyway, with judgment, focuses on the Middle East. And it focuses there for a variety of reasons. It could have been different. I just want you to think that that's so natural to us. We think that the Middle East, well, of course, not of course. That's all part of God's plan. We see that as key to God's long-term plan of redemption. But the way things are going to play out is in the Middle East. Because if you just think about it, suppose you were in another country and you were just tootling along about your own business and you were doing fine, you might not ever care what happens to the Arab countries and Israel in the Middle East. You could literally live your life without ever caring what happens there. That's not the case for us. And part of that is the way we understand, as Christians, history coming to its planned conclusion. So this is a busy chart, but just to remind you, the dispensational view of the end times, in other words, this is the dispensational understanding of Book of Revelation. So you have Israel on the time before Christ. From Christ until the rapture is the church age. And so this time period we're living in now is a time period where Jesus came to bring in his kingdom according to dispensational point of view. Everything I say is from that point of view now, is Jesus came, offered to set up the kingdom, fulfill the promises for Israel. Israel rejected the message. Gentiles come into grace, into the church, both Jew, Gentile, male, female, slave, free, no ethnic boundaries, and you become God's people by grace through faith. And so there will come a time in the future, according to the dispensational view, there will be a rapture, and all of the Christians will be taken up or raptured into heaven. But things don't end here on earth after that happens. So you've got 7 years of tribulation then that follow, and you have the Antichrist. You have a lot of things happening in that 7 years. But then you have Christ's second coming, and you have Armageddon. And, of course, Christ defeats the Antichrist, the false prophet. And then The dispensational view says God deals with the Jews and national Israel, and Christ rules for 1,000 years from Jerusalem over Jewish people who now do believe that he is the Messiah, the Son of the living God, and fulfills the rest of the promises made to Abraham. This is, again, dispensational view. If you find yourself disagreeing with this, fine, I'm just giving you this one point of view. But it is probably the most popular point of view right now. At the end, the nations revolt, and then you have final judgment. This follows the book of Revelation in a very chronologically linear fashion. You know, chapter 17 happens, then chapter 18, then chapter 19, then chapter 20. And so this is what it looks like if you lay it out in a linear way. So what's the big point here is that God is not finished with the Jewish people. God is not finished with Israel. This 1,000-year millennium is going to be about Israel because church is gone, right? Church is raptured. That tends to keep a focus on Israel, even though the church says that's not, I won't be part of that as the church. Nevertheless, this is part of God's plan. So that is, in a nutshell, why you see Christians today in the West very focused on what's happening in the Middle East. And does that track with that chart that I just showed you? In other words, do the things that are happening in the Middle East track with what you see happening there? So let's switch sides now. So we looked at it from kind of the Western Christian point of view. Let's switch sides and let's look at it from the Islamic point of view. And to understand Islam, I'm not going to go into great depth because we don't have time to go into great depth, but I'll give you the base idea. And these are the key things that we need to know to understand why things are happening the way they are today. So let's go back in time. We are going to go to Saudi Arabia, which wasn't Saudi Arabia then, just the Arabian Peninsula. We're going to a town called Mecca. In 570, this is AD 570, so get your mind around this. Old Testaments happen, New Testaments happen, Christ has been here, died on the cross, resurrected. By 570 AD, the church is very widespread in the world. So a lot's going on. But in AD 570, a man named Muhammad is born. And Muhammad, so here's the short story of his life. When he's 6 years old, he's orphaned, raised by an uncle. When he's 25 years old, his uncle's a trader, so he learns how to do caravans and trading and that kind of thing. When he's 25 years old, he marries a wealthy widow. So Muhammad is kind of set up and kind of his life's tooling along really well. When he's 40 years old, in 610 AD, he became very disillusioned because in those days, in the Arabian Peninsula, it was tribal, the Arabian tribes. They were not unified. There was a lot of warring. There were so many different gods being worshipped. The moon god, there were some Christians there worshiping Jesus. There were some Jews there. There were just all kinds of worship going on. And in Mecca, there, because they were traders, they literally had a shrine to every god you could imagine. So if you came in and you're a trader and you're worshiping somebody from Iraq, they've got a statue for Jesus. They've got Moses there. They've got every god that you could think of. Muhammad becomes very concerned about this. He feels like this is not right. And being descended through Ishmael to Abraham, he remembers that Abraham, our forefather, believed in one true God. So he begins to think that, you know, maybe there really is just one true God, and maybe Abraham was right, and maybe we ought to worship the way our forefather worshiped. Well, he goes away for these little retreats, and he's in a cave when he's 40 years old, and he receives a revelation from Allah. Allah just means God in Arabic. So I'm just going to say God, all right, but Allah. So he receives a vision from God through the angel Gabriel. And he can't read or write. He doesn't write this down. He just recites it. And that's where the word Quran comes from, is to recite something. So he memorizes and recites these visions that he gets. And each one of the visions that he gets over the next rest of his life, spoiler alert, he's gonna die in 632. So for 22 years, he gets these visions. And each chapter of the Quran, it's called a surah, S-U-R-A, but it's a chapter of the Quran, is a vision that he got somewhere in this 22 years. So he begins to preach that there's one true God, and he's heard from the one true God. Well, the people in Mecca, they don't like this, and they eventually run him out of town in 622. So he and his followers, as a small group of followers, make the trek to Medina. This little flight is called the Hijra. This is the beginning of the Muslim calendar. That's year zero in the Muslim calendar. So if you look at dates today in the Muslim calendar, it'll have some date AH. So after this date. So that's when the Muslim calendar starts, is when he fled to Medina. So he goes to Medina, and the Meccans continue to fight against him because they think worshiping one God's bad for business. But he eventually, to shorten the story a little bit, in 630 AD, goes back, conquers Mecca, forgives his enemies, destroys all of the idols, and claims that we will worship the one God. He is successfully unites around this new religion called Islam. Around this new religion, and by force of arms, unites the Arabian Peninsula and the Arabian tribes. Said, look, we're all descendants of Abraham. There's one true God. His name is Allah. His name is God. And I have seen these visions, and here's how we're supposed to live, and here's what we're supposed to do. That is the beginning of Islam. Okay? So, he dies, 632. And so there's already a movement. I mean, very quickly, these Arab armies, in the name of Islam, begin to burst out of here and start conquering. They go into Egypt and conquer. I mean, you think of all these nations now as being Muslim nations. They weren't originally. It came out of the Arab peoples in Saudi Arabia. But they burst out very successfully, military successful and religiously successful, mainly religiously successful because they're militarily successful. Those two things went hand in hand. Well, when he dies, though, there came to be a little bit of an issue. These are the first successors of Muhammad, and the successors came to be known as caliphs. So they would be the ruler of the military empire of all these tribes and sort of the high priest. I mean, they would also be the religious ruler. That's what Muhammad was. He was their political ruler and the religious ruler, okay? Same position. So when it came time for his succession, there were quite a few people who said, this is the way you're supposed to do it. We need to find Muhammad's son, doesn't have one, but Ali is his nephew and adopted son. And so some people said Ali should be the next caliph. He's a Muslim, he's related to Muhammad, he should be our leader, and he should be our prophet. He should be our religious leader. And these people were called the party of Ali. And they said, that's how we're going to find a successor. But the Arab tribes, that's not how they chose a chieftain of the tribe. They would get a little council together, and when one chief of the tribe died, they would get a council together, and a council was called a sunnah. And they would get this little council together and they would say, okay, well, you know, Bob died and the next three most capable people, you know, are these three, we're gonna choose one to lead us. So they didn't see a hereditary. It wasn't a hereditary thing for them. So while Ali was burying Muhammad, the rest of the leaders, military leaders, get together and have a little sunnah, have a little conference, and they pick this guy, Abu Bakr. Well, the party of Ali's supporters go, this is not the way it's supposed to work. We're really unhappy about this, but fine. We'll get you next time. Well, he doesn't rule very long. And in 634, they go, surely now we will. And they say, nope, we're going to pick another guy. Now, in the meantime, these guys, particularly this guy, hugely militarily successful. They are conquering, just bursting out of the Arabian Peninsula, conquering place widely, all the way to Turkey and Egypt and up into Iran and Iraq. I mean, they are very militarily successful. So this guy, Uthman, not so much a military guy, but this is when the Quran is put together, very early. And so now they write down the visions that Muhammad had. And so the Quran wasn't now not just verbal, it was written down. So it's very early. And so they write down the Quran. Then finally, the next time, they pick Ali. But by this time, you have two groups. You have the people that came to be known as Shia, or Shiites, and people that came to be known as Sunni. And really what this came down to was two different ways of thinking about how you choose the leaders. Shiites, and this is true all the way to today, Shiites believe that your secular leader, your king, your chieftain, whatever, your military leader, and your religious leader should be the same person, just like Muhammad was. Sunnis say, no, we're all Muslims, and we've got our priests, kind of ayatollahs, imams, we've got our holy people, but the people running the country and the military and all that, they don't need to be priests or prophets or anything. So they have a little bit of a separation, right? I mean, they're all Muslims, but they have it's not a secular leader, but not a priest for a leader. And so the way that you choose succession was early became a split between the Shiites and the Sunnis. And that split is still making a difference in the Middle East today. This really came to a head in 680. So we're still close. Remember, Muhammad dies in 632. And then in 680, So Ali is becomes the, when Ali dies, now he's got two sons. He's got a son named Hassan, and he's got a son named Hussein. In America, Hussein is usually spelled. So think Saddam Hussein, etc. That's a really good traditional Islamic name. So he's got two sons. Well, he passes it on to Hassan, but some of the Sunnis poison him. And when they do, his brother Hussein takes a group of a couple hundred people and is on their way to raise an army to claim, now they're fighting each other, okay? So to claim that he's the new caliph, he gets ambushed at a town called Karbala. And so the Sunni troops, numbering several thousand, surround Hussein with 72 men and a bunch of women and children, and they cut them off, and they have no drinking water. Finally, Hussein and the men ride out to battle. They're all killed, cut their heads off, take the women and children and take them away. And so the Sunnis say, I think we're going to decide who's going to be the successor to Muhammad. Seriously bad blood. This town is still a pilgrimage site ever since 680 AD, and every year Shiites remember this and celebrate it with great sadness and mourning. Not really destined to bring people together, right? It's like every year we're going to remember what those dirty Sunnis did to Ali's sons. So, needless to say, over time, you still see this Shia-Sunni split, and it's gotten emotional as well. Over time, they're both Muslims, but their traditions vary just a little bit over time. The number of times they pray and some other things are a little bit different, but they're all Muslims. So that's the history of the Sunni-Shia split. It goes all the way back into the 6th century, in the 7th century, in the 600s, and still there today. So let me show you a chart. This is a world chart of the distribution of Islam in the world. The light green are Sunni, and the dark green, these are the Houthi rebels. This is Hezbollah. This is Iran, Iraq. Basically, these are Shia. So Shiite Muslim. About 10 to 15% of Muslims in the world. There are 1.9 billion Muslims in the world. Just for reference, because I know what you're thinking, 2.4 billion Christians. So 2.4 billion Christians, 1.9 billion Muslims. About 10 to 15% of the Muslims are Shiites. Always been a minority. 80 to 85% of Islam is Sunni. And I want you to think about this for a minute. If every nation that you look at in green that is Sunni, the leader of the country is not their priest, not their prophet. You've, in Saudi Arabia, you have a king. And in Egypt, you have an elected official. It's not democracy, but you have, you know, more of a president, right? There. And in Qatar, you have the emirs, you know, the different political organizations, but whoever is running it is not their priest. So you sort of have a church and state thing. They're still predominantly Muslim, but the church and state are split. The areas that are in green and the one that's a nation is Iran. Iran, the political leader and the spiritual leader are Ayatollah Khamenei today. He runs both. Do they have a president? Yes. Does he do what he wants? No. Everybody does what the spiritual leader says, and they think we're the only ones doing it right. That's the way it was with Muhammad. That's the way it should be today. Needless to say, there's a lot of tension between Shia and Sunnis for a variety of reasons, and we'll go into more of that next week, but there's a lot of tension in between them. But one of the natural tensions is that any Shiite group, because there are little groups, Hezbollah, for example, is a Shiite-funded group. Their version of Islam is Shiite. Well, they're in Lebanon, which is a Sunni country, and how do you think they think Lebanon should be run? By a religious guy. And so it is not uncommon to try to overthrow Muslim governments to institute something like what Iran has. So the Sunni countries oftentimes suppress some of their Muslim brothers, if you will, who are trying to overthrow their country. Almost every one of these countries. Sadat in Egypt, he was assassinated by another Muslim. The king of Jordan was attempted assassination several times by other Muslims. Why? Don't like the way this is run. You guys are not religious enough. You're not running the country right. We're supposed to be one big Muslim family, okay? The word for this, if you hear the word Islamist, an Islamist organization basically wants all Muslims to be one big group of people and all ruled together. They don't really like nations. They think the whole, all the Muslims in the Middle East ought to be one big country, so to speak. That's what Islamist means, okay? So here's just a breakdown, nice little chart, kind of breaks down the split. This is not all of the sects, obviously, but here are the basic Sunni groups, and here are the Shiite groups right here, and then there's some outliers. Again, there are so many different sects, but broadly speaking, just like in Christianity, you might broadly say, well, there's Catholics and Protestants, and they're the Eastern Orthodox, and they've all diverged. They're all Christian, but they all diverged in history. Well, that's kind of this. You get these different groups. And a number of these, if you paid a lot of attention to it, are pretty radical groups. This group in particular, I want to talk to you about in a minute. But that's kind of the Sunni-Shia split, and I want to move on from there. Okay, so that split still has impact today, and they're fellow Muslims, so they all hate Israel. Okay, I just want to make sure you realize they all hate Israel, right? But they also don't get along with each other very well because they have some fundamental differences. So let's go back and let's look at the Quran. What are some of the things we'll stop here because I think we might have a question. But what I want to go into next is, okay, so now we know where the Shia and Sunnis came from. Now let's look at the Quran and let's look at the Quranic verses that teach them how to deal with other people. Remember, we're going toward an end time scenario. How to deal with other people. But let me stop there. What question do we have?
Do you have a map or do you know the Muslim distribution in the United States?
I do not, and I didn't look that up. Very, very small Muslim population in the United States. I understand that the Muslim population in the United States gets quite a bit of coverage in our news media, but the number of Muslims in America is very small. And as far as how many are Shiite, how many are Sunni, I do not know. I don't know if that's known, but if it is known, I don't know it at the moment. But I'll look that up. If there were some kind of census of that, which there may not be. So America, though, very small Muslim population, percentage-wise. Okay, so let's jump into Quran. The Quranic chapters are numbered, but they aren't in chronological order. In other words, remember, Muhammad claims to have gotten these visions from God over a 22-year period. So chapter 1 and chapter 5 aren't in chronological order. What I'm going to show you is I'm going to show you kind of a chronological order of this. And this is important because Islam has a principle called abrogation. Abrogation, which is not a religious term, it simply means that what I said to you yesterday could be overridden by what I'm saying to you today. Abrogation is alive and well in our marriages, right? I know I told you yesterday that I was going to go out and mow the yard, but that's overridden by what I'm saying today, which is no, I'm not. All right, so abrogation is basically what I said then has been overridden. So let's look at this chronologically. This is an older one. Argue only in the best way with the people of the book. The people of the book are Christians and Jews because Christians and Jews also go back their faith tradition to Abraham. And so they are not treated like the same way as infidels, unbelievers, okay? They're cousins, if you will. And so what he says is they're wrong, according to Islam, argue in the best way, except those who act unjustly. Say, we believe in what was revealed to us and in what was revealed to you. Our God and your God is one. We are devoted to him. Islam's position is that Allah is the same God as Abraham's God, Isaac, Jacob, the God and Father of Jesus Christ, although they definitely don't think he's the Son of God. But they believe this is the same God. And they believe that Muhammad, the fundamental confession of Islam is there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. So Muhammad is the one that definitively told you how this is really going to work. And in the Quran, you've got Jesus shows up, and Noah shows up, and Moses show up, but nobody's as great as Muhammad. So they just think you guys are wrong, and you need to be converted. But at least we're cousins in the sense that we worship the same God. So this is pretty peaceful. Later, say, disbelievers, I do not worship what you worship, and you do not worship what I worship. I will never worship the way you do, and you will never worship the way I do. You have your religion, and I have mine. Well, that's really peaceful, isn't it? I mean, it's sort of live and let live, right? This is Muhammad when he is being pursued and in the minority, and want and live and let live would have been good for them. Fight in Allah's cause against those who wage war against you, but do not commit aggression. Don't start a war, for verily Allah does not love aggressors. Slay them wherever you may come upon them, and drive them away from wherever they drove you away, for oppression is even worse than killing. So now, getting a little stronger, and what his point is that we're not going to attack everybody else, but if we're attacked, we will wage war, okay? Because oppression is even worse than killing and defending yourself. So now this is the time period where the Muslims are beginning to battle those that disagree with them or push back against those that disagree with them. When the four forbidden months are over, wherever you encounter the idolaters, unbelievers, kill them, seize them, besiege them, wait for them at every lookout post. But if they repent, maintain the prayer and pay the prescribed alms, let them go on their way, for Allah is most forgiving and merciful. What is this saying? It's saying now, clearly, chronologically, in a much stronger position, saying if they're an unbeliever, they're going to die or they're going to convert, and Allah will forgive them. You notice how we're getting a little more belligerent as time goes on. Fight those people of the book. Now we're talking about the cousins, right? That's my word, not exactly what Islamists would call it. But fight those people of the book who do not truly believe in Allah and the last day, and who do not forbid what Allah and his messenger have forbidden, who do not obey the role of justice until they pay the tax. This right here is a tax. So if you were a Jew or a Christian, you could continue to be a Jew or Christian for the sake of the fact that Abraham was your father if you paid a tax. You can't preach, you can't convert, but in order to spare your life, like all the rest of the unbelievers, remember we just talked about, if they don't convert, kill them. But if you're people of the book, we'll kill you too, unless you pay the tax, okay? So I just want you to see how this plays out historically. Still, again, in the Quran, those who say God is the Messiah, the son of Mary, we're talking about Christians now, have defied Allah. The Messiah himself said, children of Israel, worship God, my Lord and your Lord. If anyone associates others with Allah, that means the fundamental confession of the Christian faith is Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Blasphemy. That's what this is talking about. If anyone associates others with Allah, Allah will forbid him from paradise and hell will be his home. No one will help such evildoers. So you notice we're getting stronger and stronger, and we're getting stricter and stricter as time goes by. So I want to just stop there because it is very controversial, and not all Muslims think you ought to go kill unbelievers. There's more to this than what I'm telling you. But what I'm telling you is that the groups today who are doing violent jihad trace their authority to do so from here. Okay, so I'm not saying to you every Muslim thinks you ought to go kill every Christian and Jew. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying the ones that do trace it to there. And that's just, you just got to be honest about that. That is where that authority comes from. So we're going to move now into, well, then what does the Quran say about the end time? But before we do that, what questions do we have?
The people who are perpetrating violence based on this, which sect are they in? Are they both Sunni and Shia, or one or the other?
Good question. There are Sunni radical groups and Shiite radical groups. There are groups who are participating in jihad in both. I'll give you a simple example that you'll know is Hamas are Sunni, Hezbollah are Shiite. So they don't agree necessarily religiously, but they definitely agree about how you should treat Israel, don't they? So that's an example of radical groups who would pursue this in a very violent way. Some are Sunni, some are Shiite. So it isn't confined to one or the other. It's a good question. So let's move on and say, well, given all of that, you got the Sunni-Shiite split, you've got the Quran talking about how do you relate to outsiders, and you can just think through history how that's played out. What does the Quran have to say about the end times? How does this thing play out in the long run? So here's a few things there. So the Quran has an idea, just like Judaism, but certainly like Christianity, that there will be a judgment day, that there's a last day, that God will judge people, and there is a heaven called paradise, and there is a hell called hell. Okay, so I mean, there are a number of similarities here. I probably should have spent some time on that. So both Christianity and Islam think there's a judgment day. Go to heaven, go to hell. God is going to intervene. He's going to judge people. So when the trumpet, and by the way, a lot of what you're seeing, and particularly in the end times, is going to go, man, I know that's in the Quran, but that sure sounds a lot like the New Testament, or sure sounds a lot like the Old Testament. Let me remind you, Muhammad was aware of and had heard the Old Testament, and he was aware of, because there were Christians and Jews in Mecca, and when he's growing up, he's in 570 AD. So, I mean, there are a lot of Christians around, there are Jews around, and so he is familiar with the Old Testament and the New Testament. So when you read the Quran, it's going to sound, and some of this end time stuff's going to go, well, that sounds a lot like the New Testament or the Old Testament. Well, if you're a Muslim, you would say, well, that may be, but that's what the angel Gabriel told Muhammad. If you're a Christian or a Jew, you would say, well, that's because Muhammad had read those, right? So when the trumpet is blown with a single blast, this sounds like the book of Revelation, and the earth and mountains are lifted up and crushed with a single blow. I mean, this could come out of Revelation. It's not the same wording, but it could. On that day, the terror shall come to pass, and heaven shall be split. For upon that day, it will be very frail, and the angels shall stand upon its borders. And upon that day, eight shall carry above them the throne of the Lord. Sounds a little like the vision of Ezekiel, etc. But basically, the end times, trumpet sounds, throne of God comes, carried by angels. It's time to judge the world. On that day, you shall be exposed, and not one secret of yours concealed. In other words, God will know everything you've ever done. There are no secrets before God. Then as for him who is given his book in his right hand, he shall say, here, take and read my book. Certainly, I thought that I should encounter thy reckoning. So he shall be in a pleasing life in a lofty garden. This is paradise. Its clusters nigh together. Eat and drink with wholesome appetite for what you did long ago in the days gone by. So Allah is going to weigh your deeds. You'll see that in a minute. But you're going to be given something. And if it's given to your right hand, which is the clean hand in Middle Eastern things, then that's a sign you're going to heaven. But as for him who is given the book in his left hand, the left hand is always the dirty hand, he shall say, would that I had not been given my book and not known my reckoning. I wish I'd lived my life differently. Would it had been the end. My wealth has not availed me. My authority is gone for me. Take him, fetter him, and roast him in hell. So this is judgment. People going to heaven, people going to hell. Their deeds have been weighed, and they've been given their book by Allah. The day of resurrection is in truth the day on which deeds shall be weighed. Those with good deeds weigh heavy in the balance shall be saved, and those whose deeds are slight, and those who have wronged themselves by transgressing against the signs and against the messengers of God. So you get this sense of judgment will be by weighing your good deeds and bad deeds, and your good deeds need to weigh more than your bad deeds. And then the book is given to you. So you get this sense of a judgment, and the judgment is based on what? The Quran. What Muhammad, the messengers of God, have said to you, and did you follow it or did you not follow it? So you get the sense of a judgment day. That's the same in both Christianity and in Islam. There are some characters that come into play in the end times. And this is from the Hadith. This is not in the Quran. This is from the early traditions, and it's from the early Sunni traditions, that there will be the deceiver, Al-Dajjal, the deceiver. And according to tradition, he will be physically deformed, blind in his left eye. He'll ride a white donkey. he will be able to perform miracles to mislead. Who does this sound like in the book of Revelation? Antichrist. See, that's who this sounds like, right? He will try to put mankind on a level with Allah by claiming to be God. Those who refuse to believe in him will be persecuted. He will be killed by Issa. Issa is Jesus. That's just the Arabic name for Jesus. That Jesus will kill him. Okay, so this is the Quran, and it's eerily similar in some respects, right, to the book of Revelation. So the deceiver will come in the end times. An Islamic tradition, this is a Sunni tradition as well, about Jesus. The prophet, peace be upon him, the prophet is Muhammad. There is no prophet between me and Jesus, meaning Jesus to Muhammad, no other prophets, and Jesus is a good prophet, but he's not as good a prophet as Muhammad. Okay, he's not as high as Muhammad. Jesus will descend to the earth. When you see him, you will recognize him. He will be a man of medium height, reddish fair, wearing two light yellow garments, looking as if drops were falling down from his head, though it will not be wet. He will fight for the cause of Islam, because in the Quran, everybody, Noah, Moses, Abraham, everybody has been a Muslim in the sense that they have worshiped the God of Abraham and they have done it right. Well, what about the Jews and the Christians that don't do it the way the Quran is? They have deviated from what Jesus really wanted and what Moses really taught. You'll see that in a minute. He will break the cross because they don't believe Jesus was crucified on the cross. They will kill swine, abolish the tax. God will perish all religions except Islam. He will destroy the deceiver and will live on the earth for 40 years and he will die. So Jesus is going to come. He's going to break the cross and say, you Christians, you've got this totally wrong. You know, you need to be a Muslim. And he will just get rid of the tax because now they'll all be Muslims. And he will kill the Antichrist, right? And then he will live for 40 more years and then he will die. So this is the Quranic view of the end times. One more character that I want to reach back in time, and I want to talk to you about the 12 imams. These are 12 Shia. So if you think about from Muhammad, all the caliphs, all the successors of Muhammad down through the ages, if you're a Shiite, not all of them are legitimate, are they? Because they were chosen by the Sunnis. There were only 12 that were legitimate. So first, you have Muhammad, right? And then his successors, the first one is Ali. Well, he wasn't the first successor, but he's the first legitimate one if you're a Shiite, right? Because he's related to Muhammad. Who's related to Ali? Hassan and Hussein. And these 12 are not in chronological order at all, because most of the caliphs were Sunnis, but they would say that 12 of them have been legitimate, that like Iran, they've been the political leader and the religious leader. But the 12th one of these, whose nickname is the Mahdi, which means the rightly guided one, you notice there's no death for him. He was, well, non-Islamic scholars think he was killed. Shiites believe God took him away and God will bring him back at the end times. So you've got the deceiver who's coming, Antichrist. You have Jesus who's coming and you have the Mahdi coming. According to both Sunni and Shia tradition, the Mahdi is a messianic figure who will bring justice to the world and restore the true religion, Islam. He will appear with a loud cry from the skies. He'll be a descendant of Muhammad, and obviously through Ishmael. His name will be Muhammad. He will emerge from Mecca, and his kingdom will be based in Iraq. He and Jesus will fight together against the Antichrist before Jesus dies. He will correct the false practices in Islam, just like Jesus is going to set all the Christians straight about the things that they've been doing wrong. He will rule for 7 years, I think 7 years of tribulation. I mean, a lot of these things are eerily familiar before the final judgment. So let me show you kind of the chart. Islamic chart, way simpler, or I made it simpler. We live here in the time of minor signs, meaning there are some signs that the end times are coming, that the deceiver's going to show up, that Jesus will come back and defeat him, that the Mahdi will come back, and 7 years later, and he'll set up an Islamic kingdom over all the earth, and then 7 years later, judgment happens. Okay, so that's the end of the world scenario there. The minor signs are moral decay, wars, injustice, people get greedy, they become less religious. Kind of, if you're a Muslim looking at this, you go, well, looks like we're headed that way, doesn't it? Major signs are the appearance of these figures. And then, of course, you'll have big wars in here. Because one of the key differences between Islam and Christianity is, in Revelation, when Jesus comes back, he will defeat the enemies. Say you're dispensationalist, okay? And say you think we're doing Armageddon here. You've got Israel, and you've got all the nations of the earth battling against Israel. Jesus is coming back, and he will destroy them with the word of his mouth, right? Not so much here. Here, all the Muslims will take up arms and conquer everybody under the leadership of the Mahdi. Christians in the world end time scenario don't fight anybody. Jesus fights the battle. In Islamic end times, of course you have the Mahdi, but it's Muslims that fight and establish the kingdom. I'm just pointing out there are differences in this, okay? So then, and then finally, you will have the judgment day. So you've seen the Sunni-Shia split, so they have some slightly different views, they have some animosity, and yet you've seen the Quran, they have some shared animosity towards unbelievers, even Jews and Christians. And their end time scenario is everybody's a Muslim or you're toast, okay? So that's kind of how they see the end times playing out. They also, just like I told you, the dispensationalists have a rapture index, like how close are we getting? You know, they look at the things happening and track it with the book of Revelation and say, I think we're getting close. So does Islam. I mean, they don't have a rapture index, but they basically are looking going, hey, I think we're getting close. Let's get our weapons ready. I think the end times are coming. So the interesting thing is both Christians, for different reasons, and a lot of Muslims, both look at events in the Middle East and think that the end times is coming. Rather unfortunate. Questions?
What is Sharia law?
Good question. Sharia law is not something that you, well, okay, let me just try and track this. First of all, Sharia law is following the rules of the Quran. The Quran is a, it isn't just a religious document that you should pray five times a day and you should give alms and, you know, it isn't just religious. It encompasses how you live. If you steal, cut your hands off. If you do this, you get killed. So it's a civil law and a religious law, okay? So it's living by Quranic law called Sharia. Some of it's been added by other people later and interpreted, but big picture, it's Quranic law. If you're a Shiite, you are big on Quranic law. Why? Because you think that your country is not just, you don't just have a king and a bunch of pastors or imams, they're the same thing. The laws of your country ought to be Sharia law. If you're Sunni, yes, you're Muslim, so you believe in Sharia law, but if you're in Saudi Arabia, you might be thinking about letting women drive. Because if you're Mohammed bin Salman, going to be the leader of Saudi Arabia, you've got imams and all, but you don't have to rule by Sharia law. You can make other laws. Does that make sense? So Sunnis believe in Sharia law, but they don't think it necessarily needs to be the law of the kingdom. They've got church and state kind of separated. So that's what Sharia law is. That's why you will see Sharia law being implemented by the Taliban and by Iran. Not so much, I'm picking on Saudi Arabia, but let me just pick on Saudi Arabia. Some elements of Sharia law, they do in Saudi Arabia, but other things they don't. They're more, quote, liberal, right, than Iran. Obviously, going to Saudi Arabia feels constricted to Western liberals, but it's way less constricting than Iran, right? So Sharia law is the Quranic law, and the intensity with which it is followed depends on the intensity of the group. You'll see Sharia law, an attempt to institute that in certain places in Europe and even in the United States. The people that are doing that have a particular ideology about what Islam is. So,
How do the Muslims, believing that Allah is the God of the Old Testament, how do they deal with the Old Covenant and the Jews as far as who they were in God's promise?
Yes, good question. So Muslims see the Old Testament as legit. The Jews changed it. And they see the New Testament as legit. The Christians aren't doing it right, and they lied about some of it. In other words, they do think that those are revelations and those are prophets from God. They think that we have changed it. So, for example, I've used this before. It's the easiest one. In the Old Testament, Abraham is going to sacrifice Isaac. God provides the ram, says, child of promises, Isaac and the Jews. Well, in the Quran, that's not the way that story reads. It's Ishmael, and he was going to sacrifice, and Ishmael is the one that inherits things. Hence, the argument about who really should have Jerusalem, right? We're descended from the older brother. Well, we're descended from the younger brother, but God said it was us. They said, not according to our book. So, and then Christians say that Jesus is God. It's like, oh, that is like the big blasphemy. Like, no, there is no God but Allah. Jesus is just a prophet. And we say, well, he was died on a cross. No, there's no way God will let his prophet die on a cross. He didn't really die on a cross. You Christians have made that up. So I'm really shorthanding this, but basically they do think that those are real prophets. They just think we have corrupted that. Jews and Christians have corrupted it. That's why when they say Jesus, Isa, will come and correct the Christians, he'll set all that stuff straight.
So do Shia and Sunni think that they will align for the end times?
In the end times, here's the way this is going to play out. There are just so many different sects, and I want you to get to realize that Islam is not monolithic any more than Christianity is monolithic. You have cultural Christians, you have devout Christians, same in Islam, right? But big picture, Sunnis don't agree that the Shiite way of doing things is the way to do things. But when push comes to shove and it's time to be fellow Muslims versus the unbelievers or versus the Jews, they are together. Although, next week we'll talk about, is that really still true or not? But that's next week. But yes, fundamentally as Muslims, a lot of the things I'm telling you are from Sunni and Shia traditions as well.
The Muslim religion is expanding. What is their primary method of conversion?
Their primary method of conversion is called having a lot of children. Seriously, I don't have stats on this, but basically, I'm not saying that Muslims wouldn't want to convince someone to become a Muslim. I'm not saying every Muslim wants to kill their neighbor. I'm not saying that at all. And they might say, hey, read this. This is true, and I want to evangelize you, okay? There are different ways to do jihad. And one of them is just talk to your neighbor and tell them Islam's the way to be. But fine. That happens. But it's not a lot of evangelistic conversion. But if you're born into a Muslim family, high percentage, you're going to be Muslim, culturally as well as religiously. So the growth of Islam is primarily based on having children more than evangelism, by far. Christianity, in the West, Christian birth rates are going way down. So if Christianity is going to grow, it's going to have to grow by evangelism, and it's not in the West, but it is in Asia and South and Africa. those are probably the areas where it's growing. And a great deal of that is conversion, evangelism, conversion.
We see violence that is related to a belief that violence will bring about the final imam, and we see violence that comes from Quranic justification. What are the best ways for us in the modern world to deal with that?
Yeah, so from a Christian point of view, our behavior isn't dictated by our enemy's behavior. Our behavior is dictated by being a follower of Jesus Christ. Christ will fight our battles. As a nation, the United States, part of what the United States is built, is made for, protect its citizens. And the United States should protect its citizens from terrorism and from other things like that. However, we as Christians would not consider conquering another country and telling them you need to become Christian. That's not how we spread Christianity, right? So I would suggest that the one big thing, we may disagree on exactly how we should deal with the Middle East, fair enough, but the one big thing is that we are not, as Christians, going to win this by conquest or violence. That is not our way. Defense, yeah, Christians feel differently, but most Christians would say, well, we should defend ourselves, but we are not going to attack another country and take over their land and tell them they need to become Christian. Has it happened in history? Of course it's happened in history. People have abused everything. But to be fair, there are Muslim countries that are not trying to take us over as well. And I would think you could live at peace in the world in that case. Next week, we'll look at, is that possible and where might it be possible? So one last thing is, last time I showed you how support for Israel really in America really went with how religious, how Christian we were in America, how many Christians you have, and support for Israel went that way. Makes sense, right? They're part of the thing. This is a terrible handout, and I apologize for putting it on there because it's extremely minuscule. This is just to get you to learn that you have a magnifying app on your phone. Okay, I use it all the time. Just touch that little magnifying glass. You can read this. But I just want to show you. This is basically, even up there, you can read that fine. This is asking all these countries, down the left are all these countries by region. And it's kind of handy that they're by region because Islam is very prominent in certain regions. And the question that was asked is, how important to you is religion in your daily life? Because what we've been talking about is this end time scenario from a Christian point of view and from an Islamic point of view are based very largely on your religious beliefs and what God is doing in the world. And they're very different, but they're based on religious belief. And so we looked last week, as religious belief in America goes down, one example, there are a lot of fallout from that, but one is support for Israel goes down. Look how these countries answered, the people answered, how important is religion in your daily life? These are Muslim countries. Well, just look, you can see. And look how important religion is in their life. I want to show you on here, there were two that were particularly interesting. If you will look at the United States, look how relative, I'll just tell you that number used to be higher. So in the U.S., 57% of people say religion is important to me in my daily life. That is way, way, way down. Then I want you to look at Israel on that chart. And notice that Israel is sitting at a very, to us, very low 30%, right? Israel is much, much more secular than you think they are. We as Christians think, well, we support Israel partly because of our faith and that they're God's people and they're part of God's plan. Israel is mostly secular, not very religious. So in our next lesson, one of the things we're going to talk about is not just how are the other nations in Israel working things out in the Middle East, what's happening inside Israel? Most of Israel is not acting on religious impulses. America is, to some extent. Islam definitely is, to a large extent. Israel isn't always acting on those impulses. So to kind of bring this to a close, the one thing, let's come back to our map. So from Christians, we see the end times playing out here. The interesting thing is, so does Islam. Sees it playing out there. The dispensationalists see that the events happening in the world are moving not in a neutral way, not in a more peaceful way, but in an inevitably conflicting way. 7 years of tribulation, Antichrist comes, and terrible things happen, and there are wars and all of that. They see this going toward a violent end. Not violent because the Christians are going to go shoot anybody up, but that the end's going to be violent. So do the Muslims. Different eschatology, but the idea is all these same signs are pointing to the end times and a very successful end time for them. Does that make sense? So what you basically have here is the proverbial stick of dynamite and somebody standing over here with a match. I mean, you've got the Christians saying it's going towards this ending, and you got Muslims saying, hey, us too, and guess what? We win. And part of it for us is becoming more militarized. So this sets the stage for trying to find a way to have peace in the Middle East, and is it even possible? So in our next lesson, we'll talk about how does Israel see this and what are they doing? How does the West see this and what are we doing? And then how do the Shiites and the Sunnis see this and what are they doing? You already know that Iran is trying to get a nuclear weapon. Well, that fits very nicely into their end time scenario in a very unpleasant way for Israel, right? And so as we look next time, I want everything we've studied so far, why do Christians support Israel? How do Shias view this? How do Sunnis view this? And then we'll talk about how does Israel view it? And we'll look at where are we today? Who are the players? And how does it look going forward? In other words, is the rapture index going to go up or is it going to go down during this administration? So I'll see you next week and we'll put a bow on this.